Hello and welcome to episode 115 of the Machine Ethics Podcast. This time we're talking to E.M. Lewis Jong. This was recorded on the 6th of August, 2026. E.M. and I talk about the promise of AI, speech recognition, being understood, supporting diversity and linguistic diversity, making useful technologies that have purpose, the Mozilla Data Collective, underrepresented cultures in datasets, the accidental monocultures that technology can sometimes make, negative uses of datasets, data extraction through AI services, the instability of LLMs, and much, much more. If you like this episode, you can go to machine-ethics.net. You can contact us, hello at machine-ethics.net. You can find us on Blue Sky, machine-ethics.net, Instagram, Machine Ethics Podcast, YouTube, machine-ethics. And if you can, you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/machineethics. Thanks very much and hope you enjoy. Hi, Em. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, how are you doing?
So thanks for coming on the show. Who are you and what do you do?
So I'm E.M. Lewis Jong, and I'm the founder and CEO of Mozilla Data Collective.
Thanks very much. I, as we discussed previously, I am a Mozilla person. I like the Mozillas.
Mozillian. We say Mozillian.
Mozillian. Is that? Oh, no. Yeah. That means I'm not in the know, is it? I'm a Firefox user.
You can be a guest. You can be like a plus one, Mozillian plus one.
Okay, yeah. I think, yeah. Oh, I'm outside the Mozillians of people.
Mozillaverse? Are we still allowed to say verse after things?
Mozillaverse? No, that's it. That's over now. I'm sorry.
No, yeah. It's been co-opted. I hate it.
It totally has as well, hasn't it? Before we get on a diatribe about all the things Mozilla and data and privacy and AI things, if you can, in your own words, could you tell me what you think AI is? I would like also to know kind of what is your interest in it? And then I'm going to ask you about data.
Yeah. So I think of AI, maybe I'll answer the question, what do I think AI should be? I think AI should be, like all other tools, a way to augment and extend ourselves in ways that we get to choose and control. So that's what I hope AI can be. And my interest in it, so I came at it very specifically from the perspective of language technologies. So making technology more multilingual, which now we think of as kind of synonymous with large language models. But back when I first started working on this, it was actually speech recognition that kind of caught my interest first. And in that case, it was, you know, I was operating in a multilingual family. My husband and I are from different countries. We're raising our kids in multiple languages. And we sort of thought that technology would be really helpful in this. You know, we thought it would be a really helpful tool that we would be communicating with the grandparents and we'd be like correcting each other's language learning. And actually, we were really disappointed by how kind of badly served most languages are in the world of technology. So that was sort of my intuit.
And has that changed? Because obviously, the as you alluded to, the technology has moved quite a lot since that time. How do you feel about it now?
Yeah, I am still a true believer in the possibility of these technologies. I think for so many people, like translation is to me one of the most kind of interesting use cases for these types of technologies. I mean, who doesn't want to be able to talk to everyone? So I really liked translation as a way to kind of illuminate for people what's possible. Because at the end of the day, I think technology is for making human connection easier, not usurping human connection. I think translation can be a big part of that. Speech recognition can be a big part of that. Speech synthesis can be a big part of that. I think LLMs have shown a lot of promise in terms of being able to make all of those different capabilities better and extend them. I think what has maybe changed for me is that I worry the mentality is a bit, everything has to do everything, the model has to be as big as possible. And actually, for a lot of the use cases that really caught my eye when I first started working in kind of voice and language data, it was much more focused. Mm-hmm. It was like, how do we build speech recognition systems in hospitals? How do we help children who are learning to read practice their pronunciation, and you don't necessarily need the world's largest model to do any of those things well. You just need data sets that really represent the types of people that you're trying to work with and that are skilled in the task that you've defined. And I think that is both important from a how do we make sure that we're not just building big, 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 but useful, 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 but also how do we make sure we don't burn the planet to a crisp in the process?
Yeah, I mean, I think I think you just hit it on the head there. So if we could stop doing that, that'd be great. is there a sense that we're talking about like a different way of working when we're talking about this stuff? Because obviously there's, I'm imagining if people are newish to this podcast, then they'll be familiar with generative AI, the terms. And these things have only been around for like, I don't know, 5 years. What are we, 2026? 4 years. And that blows my mind, right? 4 years of like publicly people talking about this generative LLM situation, transformers, we can say all these words, right? But before that, we were using machine learning techniques, which we then called AI, and that's what AI was at the time. Is that still the kind of stuff that we're talking about now in that way? Or is it a kind of a, those things together? Just, you know, how does that work?
Yeah, well, I think also each of us is probably operating in our own little bubbles to a degree. So maybe just to kind of step back and talk about like what Mozilla Data Collective is. Mm-hmm. Fundamentally, it's a data sharing platform. So it tends to be for uploaders who have data sets that they think can help to solve real problems that could be quite technical problems like named entity recognition in their language, which might be really rubbish, or OCR in their language, where, you know, OCR technologies might not work very well for the street signs in the village that they live in. So they tend to have kind of things in mind, like particular problems in the world that they want to solve. And then on the downloader side, they want to find high quality data sets that are hard to get from elsewhere. Elsewhere here being a kind of way of talking about the internet. Mm. Basically, if it's not on the internet, then it's data sets that are hard to find, because most of the first generation of these large language models, like the internet was really the kind of like ground zero for training data. So if you're a community that is not well represented on the internet, then you're probably being misserved or not served by the very first generations of these AI systems. So the data sharing platform that I founded was really trying to solve that problem. Like, how do we build bridges between people who want technology to serve them and people who want to access that type of data? And then kind of part two, we really wanted that to happen on the terms of the uploaders and not so much on the terms of the downloaders. Because I think so far, a lot of the way that this ecosystem has worked has been really extractive, really problematic, a lot of value being generated for some groups, whilst other groups are just like not seeing the benefits of this. And so making sure that data owners, rights holders, data stewards could really be the kind of primary beneficiaries of their data. And they could say, this is what it means to me to share my data. These are the types of causes I want to put it to work for. I want it to go, you know, I want it to be put towards education problems. I want it to go towards solving like computer vision diversity issues, because I'm sick of searching for founder and being served pictures of men, et cetera. So like people tend to have, I would say, like impact use cases in mind.
And is that, so obviously you enable that now with the Mozilla, what's it called again, sorry?
Mozilla Data Collective.
Data Collective, right.
I'm going to send you a t-shirt after this podcast, so you never forget again.
I'll be part
you did
of
that on purpose.
Mozillions. Mozillions.
Yeah, I'll send you another one like that. Mozillion t-shirt, Mozilla Data Collective t-shirt. You're going to have so many t-shirts.
That's it. You are officially the best guest. I don't get enough merch from my guests. thank you. So the you have what's OCR, just for our listeners?
Object character recognition.
Object character recognition.
So if you imagine that you want to extract the text from a picture, so like one use case might be PDFs. Loads of the world's knowledge is like trapped in PDFs, and so OCR can be run on PDFs to get the content out. But it's also useful for like street signs in the context of maps, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, it's useful for loads of stuff.
Yeah, so it's a process of image to text sort of translation.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting because I am old. I've decided now. I'm an old person, and therefore I have lived through various people talking about good things that they will do, and then it never really comes off. So I'm going to ask you some questions about your work. So be warned. Is this because I have lived through things like Tim Berners-Lee's Solid and personal data wallets and all sorts of kind of like data related ideas. Some of those are more around sovereignty of data, like making people responsible for their data and not just giving it away. Some of that mm-hmm. is to do with privacy as well. And those two things can come together quite nicely. Do you have a sense that some of those ideas ran their course, they couldn't execute well? Like, how is it, what do you think about those types of things, and how is the Mozilla thing different?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. Firstly, I'm also a passionate believer in privacy, and most of my doctoral research is really about privacy in young people and how they think differently about privacy, how they can operationalize privacy differently. So no, I think there will always be a place for people to have autonomy in how their data is moved around. But I think one thing that gives people the space and power to be autonomous is alternatives. And if there are no alternatives to the 1, 2, 3 platforms that rule the universe, that's a really big problem, because the most powerful way for you to advance agency is just vote with your feet. And if you can't vote with your feet because there's nowhere to go, that's a problem. So most of the stuff that I have done has been about trying to build alternatives. So the way that shows up in this context is, basically, we were kind of previously presented with this binary choice, right? Where it was either you have to open source everything, otherwise your people, language, culture don't show up in technology, and then your grandchildren won't speak your language, so everyone should open source everything. That's like over dramatic party line one. And then over here, it's everything should be proprietary all the time because only big companies know how to do anything. And so that's the way that this should work. And this was like the choice that we were being presented with. And I think it's a false dichotomy. There are ways for people to advance choice in sharing their data sets such that it can actually drive the things that they care about. So for example, let's say I have a data set type that is valuable to different types of organizations. I can say, hey, Mabel AI, which is a kind of secure like translation system for patients and doctors, I'm going to give you my data set for free because I believe in the work that you're doing. But you over here, company name that I won't name, you know, I expect you to pay because that's something that I want to be able to then put to work in some other way. So I think privacy is just one facet of autonomy for me. Like, I think people should control technology. Technology should not control people. And that kind of undergirds a lot of what we do. And then specifically on the privacy stuff, I mean, a lot of the ways that we have tried to help different partners is by providing data sets that they can trust to build technology that is more privacy preserving. So for example, I don't know if you know the Open Home Foundation. They do really amazing work helping people to have kind of smart speakers, et cetera, in their homes that are actually private and secure and where the data actually stays within their own remit. And like, that's the type of work that we really want to help people to do. Like, we want people to have hardware and software they can trust, basically.
Yeah. And that feels like it's part of the Mozilla kind of ethic as well. That's kind of the values there.
Yeah, that's right. And also, I should say, I mean, you know, I think Mozilla is obviously most well known for Firefox, but has a whole series of other kind of products and projects as well. And Common Voice, which is what I worked on for about 5 years before I started Mozilla Data Collective. Common Voice has been around since 2017, and it was really a response to the kind of early days of the Alexas and the Google Voice assistants. And people kind of looked at, like, what is the next privacy frontier going to be? Maybe it's going to be speech technology. And actually, I think that has really been borne out, that speech technology is one of the next privacy frontiers. So we probably want more choices and more options to exist than just a couple.
Yeah. And I guess I mean, you guys are living in this remit on the back end, right? You're helping people have a choice and maybe get some compensation over things that will help those things exist, right? You know, if someone wants to do something interesting and they don't have access to various languages, speech or just text corpus, then they might come to you. But there's also this thing on the other end where you're receiving the service, right? Have you got any kind of stories that you've had through that of people using the stuff, kind of positive, maybe even negative outcomes from people using their data and creating services?
Yeah, there are loads of positive examples. Lots of different technology providers now support more languages than ever before. And like the types of data sets that we have on Mozilla Data Collective have been a big part of that. We're not allowed to name all the different organizations that use the data sets, but I think suffice to say that often when some of these technology services become a lot more multilingual, it's often the case that it's because of communities and organizations using platforms like ours to share data sets that's happened. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of the communities we work with, people who are sharing people who are sharing Bulgarian proverbs or like Sindhi translation data sets, the best possible outcome that they can imagine actually is that technology supports their language, because they're really worried that there will be no intergenerational transmission of their language. And they're really worried that their children and grandchildren using technology will just slowly forget the language and culture that formed them. And there's already plenty of evidence that is exactly what's happening. So I think making technology more multicultural is an important thing for us to do more broadly. I think on the negative side, I never want to kind of hide from the fact that, especially for data sets which are produced and released under the most permissive licenses, on the positive side, they get amazing uptake. Like data sets that are released under a CC0 license, far and away, those are the most used data sets on our platforms. And also with a CC0 license, you lose some control, right? Like you don't have full visibility because people are free to reshare your data set elsewhere. Mm-hmm. They can create derivatives. They can mix it in with other data sets, and those can in turn be shared elsewhere, and they don't have to attribute it back to you. So you have this entire invisible proliferating web of open data that undergirds lots of what we use, and not all of those things are going to get us out of bed in the morning with joy. Some of them are not great things, but for all of those, I think there are many more examples of places where it has been really effective and impactful. Mm. I'll give you a kind of real negative example. Well, negative, controversial, shall we say. Yep. So, we had a community member who wrote into us who said, look, I've noticed that one of the data sets is being used to train a gender classifier that people are then running over other data sets where people have not chosen to self-identify with any given gender identity. And this makes me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And so in those cases, it is an open license and it's not a license that has any particular recourse, but we do at Mozilla believe that community is a powerful thing. So we reached out and just said, hey, I know that you're well within your rights to do this, but we're just going to let you know that these are some of the concerns that we heard. We leave it with you to kind of think about it. Mm-hmm. And in that context, the person actually did turn around and say, oh, thank you. I hadn't thought about that. I was actually doing this because I want these data sets to have better metadata coverage because it makes them more useful for all of these different things, including use cases that a lot of people might care about. Like, for example, if you're the product sourcing partner for like a femtech company, you probably mostly need speech clips from people of female sex. And actually, mm-hmm. it's very annoying to try and manually comb through those. So it's quite helpful if you can know which of these speech clips actually refer to people of that sex. And actually, that was a totally innocent and legitimate thing that they were trying to do. And they had not thought about the fact that people might not want to have this type of metadata associated because they hadn't identified in that particular way. And then they basically took it down. So I think, things can come out of sharing open data sets, which are not always in line with the contributor intentions. But I think being able to foster dialogue as much as possible is always helpful.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of reminds me of the Gaydar paper back in, 2019 now, something ridiculous, where they were trying to comb Facebook to identify the people who had self-identified to being straight or not, and then trying to infer from pictures of people the kinds of facial artifacts that would skew to that bias. And it's kind of like, no, this is a bad use. And even if it did work, it shouldn't be necessary to label people, because like any of these predictive technologies, like it's not 100% hit rate, right? You're not saying like this is the truth. You're drawing a graph around a load of people, and there's people inside and outside of that grouping, and that garnered a lot of attention at the time back then. But I guess you could see how people could accidentally, innocently do all sorts of odd things around that kind of personal identity space, other kind of taboo subjects.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, maybe the most sympathetic way to say it is just that tools in different hands can be very different things and do very different things, which is why we have to be so careful which tools we build.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess if people did have data, you know, and it was interesting data, what kinds of things are you looking for the platform?
Yeah, so basically the mission is to create a more multilingual, multicultural, multimodal tech future. So that's basically what we're trying to enable, like a tech future that is not just white and American and like dominated by a particular way of thinking common in Silicon Valley. Like that is a kind of nightmare scenario in my mind, is that technology doesn't reflect us. It kind of shapes us into all being kind of the same ilk. So I really worry about a future in which we're kind of being increasingly homogenized by the tech that we use. Mm-hmm. So we are anti that. We are for kind of pluralist tech futures where technology can work in lots of different ways for different types of people, where people feel seen and reflected by the technologies that they're using. So loads of different types of data sets go into that, right? So speech recognition is kind of where we started, making sure that if you are using a speech technology, it can understand you no matter what your accent is, no matter what language you're using, no matter what kind of variant you speak of a particular language. We're doing a competition at the moment called Lost in Transcription, which is specifically for multilingual people who will be, you know, just in their homes switching around between two languages, three languages, because that's what is kind of normal in most of the world, that people are not generally monolingual. Most people are multilingual. And so those types of data sets are really useful. Speech synthesis data sets are some of the most popular ones at the moment as people experiment more with kind of speech production technologies. Named entity recognition, those are often quite popular. Fact books can be really helpful, especially fact books about parts of the world that are not well represented in the types of texts that are being fed into these systems. Like if you interact with some of these language models about places or dates or events, which, you know, you might talk about a lot in one context, they recognize all of those things, but they don't recognize place names or phenomena or slang or whatever from other cultures. And so we really want to counter that in a way that like lets communities show up when they're using technology. So those types of things are useful. And then multimodal, I think this is obvious, and in my space we see it all the time, but you know, text was the kind of vanguard a few years ago, and then it was speech. And now increasingly it's video. So I think more and more kind of multimodal data sets that contain different components and kind of that are annotated properly for all of those different facets, those are really kind of popular as well.
Just as you were talking, I was thinking like there's the coverage. It's great to get coverage over, like you were saying, like the multilingual space is really interesting because it's kind of like you get very little of that, right, in writing at all. There's like people flitting between two languages or three languages, so that's really cool. I hadn't really thought about that at all.
I mean, we think there are at least 7,000 languages being spoken today, and for every language there might be a lot of different variants. So for example, English is a kind of macro language, and English between 15 different countries will be spoken really differently with different words, different accents. If you think about that kind of diversity and how we speak all over the world, I mean, we're serving like a tiny little slice of it right now, and we don't want to accelerate the kind of demise of languages because people using technologies that don't support them, so they switch to their second or third or fourth language because they want to be able to use technology. So yeah, the linguistic diversity piece is huge. And there's also just the where linguistic diversity hits other types of diversity, those are also kind of generally poorly served. Like there are sociolects, like particular ways of speaking particular languages that belong to particular groups, and those are also generally badly served. So yeah, it's people are so different, and we want to capture that in a way that allows it to continue because we think it's a good thing, and that kind of underlies everything we do. So we have about just over 1,000 data sets. The purpose of Mozilla Data Collective is not to just allow anyone to put up anything. It's kind of vetted, it's curated, it needs to pertain to the mission. It needs to be clear that you actually have the rights to share this data set, because I think there's been a lot of slightly dubious kind of scraping-like activities that mean it's really hard for us to know that the people in a data set want to be represented in that way, and that's huge. It's not just diversity at the costs of human agency. It has to be both. Like, we want to solve this problem by giving people choice and making it kind of easy for people to show up in technology on their own terms, which means they should curate the data sets, they should decide how they're annotated, they should decide what to call them, they should decide what they're for. Like, how do we put people back into this, you know?
Is it one of those things that is never ending? Because as language moves around, you know what I mean? I feel it's like a Sisyphus. Is it Sisyphus? Rolling a rock up a hill. Boulder. Does it feel like that? Because the presumption here is that the technology will need to be, the current technology we have for these things will need to kind of constantly be relearning language, because we use language and it evolves, and things, memes and things come into that language, different slang terms, words from different languages then cross over and odd things happen. New objects exist and we have to call them things. Is that something that worries you, or is that like a great challenge?
That's a great challenge. Yeah. And also, frankly, that would be a nice problem to have if that was the biggest problem. If the biggest problem was, oh no, English has changed since this last release, that would mean that we had reached such exhaustiveness in our dataset curation that we were like, yep, we're solving tomorrow's problems. Whereas I do honestly kind of feel like we're a little bit on the back foot. The technology is being rolled out faster than it's really representing some of these different things that we've been talking about. So you see systems being deployed where there are clear bias issues and clear performance issues, and we're trying to sort of solve those as we go because we think it's so important to solve them, and because we do think that they're kind of self-proliferating. But yeah, there are all kinds of interesting, like, technical challenges when you're doing this type of work. So for example, you know, a lot of the ways that we built these technologies started with English first, and so a lot of assumptions about the way the language works are kind of borrowed from English. So for example, there is an assumption about how the mapping of audio to text will work. There's an assumption that there is a standardized orthography at all. There's an assumption that there's a dictionary. So, like, if you try and then apply those techniques to languages that don't have the same structure, that don't have the same resources, don't have the same standardization, that don't have the same X, you find they don't work so well. And I think that means that there's quite a lot of it's quite a lot of work to make these systems perform really well for languages in different contexts, and trying to get that work to be not just one pilot project from one foundation, but to be a kind of new way of thinking about and deploying technology as kind of people first.
I mean, I feel like it feels like it's personally gratifying, the work that you're doing currently, and obviously hits home because you are bilingual and care about this stuff. Do you feel like in the future you can see yourself moving on to a similar challenge? Because obviously in this type of technology, there's data which affects how people interact with text and voice, and those things proliferate through the services and how you might, you know, use your Siri or Alexa or whatever the next thing is, right? Access to technology. But there's also you know, images and how people are represented, and how the types of things that these services can produce affect people. And there's a bunch of other stuff. I didn't know if you had an idea of like what other things excite you in that space.
Yeah, I think so. I see language as kind of the most foundational technology, and without language data sets and without multimodal data sets and without all these different types of data sets which enable the kind of technology I want to exist in the world, I can't do my next thing, because whatever my next thing will be will involve building on these types of things. So I see this as groundwork, like laying the foundation so that we can do the interesting, cool things next. I mean, for me personally, the thing that excites me most is actually kind of empowering everyone to be a maker for themselves. Like, I want to see more people building things that small groups of people around them can use. And I actually think that one of the more exciting and interesting things about AI is that more people are able to kind of build and deploy technology products than before. Like, it used to be that, I mean, you know, there were a bunch of kind of self-taught coders out there, but also I think having a computer science background was really felt like a barrier to a lot of people. And now you've got all kinds of people, you know, my little sister's vibe coding something. And I like that. Like, I like the idea that we'll get to live in this more vibrant, biodiverse universe of apps and technologies and systems. So I think whatever I end up doing next will probably be either trying to make sure that now people can build things for themselves, and maybe especially kind of young people, because a lot of the research work I do tends to be with young people, and in their own languages and for their own cultures. And then I do have an interest in the sort of young people safety type space. Like, I do think that one of the types of data sets that I see in the world being kind of abused is the data sets that are being harvested by companies who are inserting AI features into your experience in order to leverage your data. And I'm not sure that young people are always fully equipped to understand what they're consenting to in those contexts. Like, I want to see companies building technology on data sets which are consentful, that people meant to give them, that they wanted to give them because they cared about a particular thing, not people just kind of pillaging, because I think that's a bad thing in the world. So I also like the idea of trying to think a little bit about what are the tools that we can build to help people to understand and execute on their own privacy choices in the kind of AI-centered universe.
I feel like that's a technological headache.
Yeah.
But one which is like probably surmountable, and it comes back to that kind of personal wallet situation where you are deciding what kinds of data you are allowing people to have and for what reasons. Which is obviously, you know, pro-social. That's kind of what people, you know, if they care about that stuff, they want to be able to give people access and trust that they're going to do certain things. And I guess there's a lack of trust within the kind of big companies taking our data, scraping our data, and giving us possibly free access to these things, but also doing harmful things to us. And and certain free access to certain things. But also like using us in a way, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I think this mentality that humans are kind of batteries to power technology is wrong, bad, don't like. But, you know, one of the reasons that I was kind of attracted to work for Mozilla in the first place is that I do think open source can be part of the solution for this. I think people at the moment are renting proprietary technologies. They are not owning the technology stack that they're using. And if you are going to be plugging in your children's ailments and medical conditions and all of your psychological needs and anxieties and your career plans and your bank statements, if you're going to put it into a system, probably a system you should own and not be renting from an entity that any moment may change its privacy policies, as so many of them already have, or may change the price point, as so many of them already have. So I think what we're trying to do at Mozilla more broadly, just kind of stepping back from Mozilla Data, which is obviously trying to kind of solve the problem of data availability so that we can have better tech alternatives, Mozilla as a whole is actually trying to build out the complete stack that allows people to build and own technology, like AI technologies, for themselves. So people having their own agents that they are actually running themselves, people using, you know, email services which are end-to-end encrypted and that make it really easy for them to take their data and port it over to something else. I really like what Current AI is doing as well. They just released Alpha Chat, which again, it's encrypted. You can, your privacy choices are made clear. There's a little marker at the top so that you know that you can leave at any time. The interface is designed such that at the end of every interaction, it's not like, what can I do next for you? How about now? You want me to do more, 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 more? It doesn't do any of those things. There's no deceptive pattern deployment. So I think, like, I sometimes think that the enemy here is actually a sense of disempowerment or disenfranchisement. People can build alternatives, like, all, you know, it really requires, and this moment requires it. Not only can we build alternatives, we really have to right now, otherwise people will not have choices. So I think there is great work happening, and it's just about getting it into people's hands and building their confidence that, you know, you really don't need to rent this infrastructure. It will, I guarantee you, within a year or so, be much cheaper to be running it yourself, because it's not the case that unlimited use of X in a given day actually costs them X much. It's just that they're swallowing the cost to get you hooked so that down the line they can jack up the price. So I think just really helping people be kind of conscious of the consumer choice they're making, like, I would love to see that kind of be more part of the conversation.
I think the part of it is jacking up the price, but also if they don't jack up the price, they can do more insidious things like add ads. Or
the ads thing is the worst.
Sponsored results, right? But not showing you that they are sponsored, right?
Yeah.
There's all these things that you could do with that technology that, again, it's about this trust piece. It's like, well, you know, OpenAI said they were going to introduce ads, and then Anthropic went mad and did loads of ads to take the piss out of them. And they're like, we're never going to do this. But they have to do something, right? Like you were saying, they have to do, you know, they have to make money somehow. So something will move at some point. And it's likely not to be in our best interest. So from what we've seen, again, this is a trust piece. I mean, all that stuff chimes with me, because I'm really interested in running local stuff, making my own things, right? If you need a thing to do something, you could make it. If it's not language based, right? You know what I mean? It doesn't need to be a big LLM with loads of data. It could be something else. It could be a reinforcement learning situation, for example. So that you have choices, and I think we need to broaden our horizons a little bit with those choices.
Yeah, I think that's right. I some of the research that I do works with young people, and, you know, gets them to express sometimes what they know about kind of privacy choices or about cybersecurity or et cetera, et cetera. And I've been really struck by the fact, I think that schools are maybe not well equipped to support kind of young people and students through this quite important moment. And actually they're, you know, this is part and parcel of the generalized situation, right? Like, curricula take a long time to change. Yep. It's not quick and sudden to be like, okay, right, AI exists. Like, yeah, next week we're going to have a new approach to this. So, but I think that, you know, obviously the thoughtfulness is a strength, but the speed is a weakness in this moment, because actually you've got people whose response to a conversation about data privacy is, oh, I'll change my password. It's like, this is like, we're kind of teaching people 15 years behind where they need to be in terms of digital literacy and digital skills. So yeah, I really love the idea of equipping young people to build for themselves so that they don't feel like they necessarily have to use this thing that's being shoved at them. And I do think that's kind of the path for more control and autonomy, which, not to mention more tech skills, because actually building is really fun. Building is fun. Every child knows it. Give any child like a set of Duplo, you know, you're like, kids, come to dinner. They're like, no, I can't, because I'm building and making. I mean, like, we wish that we could all hold on to that. Like, I would literally rather build than I would eat.
Yeah,
children kind of teaches that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel very positive because about that sentiment, because I fear for myself and my work that some of that is going away, right? Because I feel like I like coding, I like designing stuff, and a lot of that is becoming a different job, right? Maybe it's not completely going away wholesale, but people are doing it in a different way, which actually doesn't mean coding and doesn't mean necessarily designing things. It's plotting something out in some text and hoping that we get the right result and reading the result, right? And that's not really where I find my enjoyment, but also where I find any learning or, you know, reinforcing of skills or sharing of ideas, thinking about ideas. Like, none of that happens at that point, as far as I'm concerned anyway. Again, a curmudgeon, but this is the feeling that I'm getting, you know, when I'm talking to people about it. And my fear is that we'll get no, the future will be no technology skills, not more technology skills. And I want to be with you and be like, no, this is enabling, and there'll be more interest in making and more interest in learning about technology, the use of technology, as well as kind of just general literacy.
Yeah, I think, you know, it remains to be seen. My instinct is this, right? Like, I mean, anyone who's built something with Claude knows it will get you kind of so far. But actually, if you want to do something that's a bit more bespoke, a bit more custom, where you already have a kind of strong vision for how you want it to behave, and then actually you're going to put it into production and it's going to be used by real people and they're going to give you feedback. Mm. I think it's sped up so much of the process of getting from zero to one, but it generally doesn't get you all of the way there to the thing that you're imagining. So I hope that it's a kind of, in a positive way, like a gateway into more technology building and creativity. I definitely think there's a risk that it will just sap people's ability to be creative and think critically, which would be such a shame, because anyone who's used any of these systems, like, you see, you know, you ask it the same question 3 days in a row, it will give you totally different answers. So, like, there's nothing stable there. So, you, like, you know, it's so persuasive and seductive, but it's like quicksand. Mm. And so people need for sure to have those critical thinking skills. People need to be able to interrogate the thing that's put in front of them. And also, you know, if you interrogate an LLM, it will kind of immediately change its mind and be like, you're right. Yes. So, okay, what about this? They're like, you're right. Like, but I said the opposite. Like, yes, you're right. So that kind of obsequiousness, I hope that people, you know, I think it's appealing for about 3 milliseconds. And then you think this is actually extremely irritating.
Yeah. Maybe you just want to know you're right all the time. I don't know. If you're not getting that from anyone else in your life, it's like, I am right. I'm right some of the time. No, I don't know. It's not healthy. Okay. Thank you so much for your time. If you have not already said it, do you have any things that excite you about AI and data in the future? Or what frightens you about this AI-mediated future we're living in?
Yeah, I think the excitement for me is all about realizing kind of two things. One is human agency, like making sure that throughout the process of sharing data and building technology, we're actually centering what people want and the real problems that people care about. And then fair value exchange. I think this is a moment of kind of industrial revolution and trying to figure out how we make it so that anything gained is shared between people. Basically, executing on those two things is the most exciting thing for me right now. And I think that's the work that needs to be done. I think, as per this discussion, some of it feels very uphill sometimes, but that does not mean it's not good to do it. If anything, it means it's even more integral to do it. And then scares me. Yeah, I think it's just, you know, I think we're sometimes sold narratives and I'm just worried we'll swallow them. Like, I'm worried that we'll just swallow the narrative that there's no choice between opening up all your data and giving it to everyone for whatever reason or being eliminated from technology. That's not a real choice. That's a fake choice that people want you to think because they don't want you to exercise your agency. And there are a lot of, versions of that in the world right now. And I just want people to remain empowered and motivated, because that's the real enemy. Yeah. Is that people just lose hope that technology can be good for them and that they get to build it on their own terms.
Thank you. That's a very good sentiment to leave on. I'm going to go and make something now, I guess. I'm just going to go and get my Legos out. And
I'm going to send you a t-shirt.
And I'm going to get a t-shirt. It's all happening today. Thanks very much for your time. How do people find out about you, message you, all that sort of thing?
Yeah. So you can go find our platform, which is mozilladatacollective.com. We're also on LinkedIn. We're also on Reddit. Come and find us. Drop us an email, depending on your generation, Ben. to your earlier comment that now I'm hoping you left in, because it'll be so weird if you cropped it out.
It's just some old man sending a letter in the post.
Yeah. You can send me a letter. Send me snail mail. Yeah. I actually love snail mail.
Snail mail. I'd love that. I haven't sent a postcard. That's what's going to happen. Postcards. So thank you very much for your time, and I will speak to you soon.
Thanks so much.
Hello and welcome to the end of the podcast. Thanks again for EM coming on the show. It was really nice to chat. And again, sorry for getting your name wrong. It was EM and not M, as I said at the beginning. I also kind of underplayed the Gaydar paper. Really grinds my gears, that paper, and the idea that it kind of starts this stark precedent, turning people into data problems rather than people in of themselves. And you get into all these sticky situations around people having flexible, changeable self-identities and allowing them to have this self-discovery as well. Or outing people falsely in cultures, which might get them into trouble, or being labeled in a certain way and not allowing these labels to move around and change over time. And again, that comes into the ethics side of things. And you know, opening people up to abuse and all this sorts of stuff. So, really, really grinds my gears, that one. And also, it's really hot in the UK at the moment. So if anyone has solved intelligence yet, the mission for DeepMind is to solve intelligence and then solve everything else afterwards. If we could just, if you've done that yet, could you just kind of solve the environmental issue that we're in already? I think I've mentioned this in the podcast before, but I've got this kind of funny thought experiment where I bet when we solve intelligence, that the intelligence AI will be like, yeah, well, I mean, you already know what to do. You need to like stop burning fossil fuels and making carbon dioxide and do all this stuff and, you know, use less energy. You know what to do. So that's it's a bit like the Hitchhiker's Guide, deep thought. It's just, you know, if we make it, maybe we'll get an answer which we already know about. Anyway, hopefully you are not too hot and you're coping with the heat where you are. I hope you are, and hopefully you can join us next time for another episode. If you can, you can find us on Patreon, patreon.com/machineethics. And if you can, tell your friends, point them to the podcast. We really are all about getting these kind of sticky, knotty ethical quandaries and questions and things out and disseminated into the people's thought processes and decision making in their work, in their lives. So if we could all do that together, that'd be amazing. Thank you so much for listening this far, and I'll speak to you next time.